From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, Malcolm Gladwell on how we've misconstrued the David and Goliath story.
And Goliath, even though he appears to be so strong, is actually in many ways acutely vulnerable. He's big, lumbering, slow-moving giant who's up against a guy with superior technology, and he can't even see him.
Later, how common are crimes like this week's theft of a Stradivarius? An art theft expert discusses the crime. We'll learn how the Harambe neighborhood is on the rise. And a coalition works on behalf of urban agriculture as its importance is recognized.
I think probably everybody in this room feels validated, you know, because this is the way that our hearts have been driving our work, knowing that this is a solution.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you listening today. For the last several months, WUWM has been investigating the high rate of incarceration among black men in Wisconsin and Milwaukee. We've heard from community leaders who say putting so many men behind bars is hurting our communities, whereas Milwaukee's police chief argues communities must be protected from those who commit crimes. Author Malcolm Gladwell is inclined to agree with the former argument that the impact on the neighborhoods outweighs the benefit in fighting crime. It's part of a broader argument about how we misunderstand power laid out in his new book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. We'll hear more of Gladwell's thoughts on Milwaukee's high rate of incarcerating black men next week. But first, he explains how what we traditionally think of as advantages may in fact work against us, and how obstacles can often be what inspire us to overcome. Gladwell explains his argument to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce with an example, how we misunderstand the classic biblical tale of David and Goliath.
The original story is perfect illustration of many of the themes I wanted to explore in the book. You have a situation where everyone assumes that the giant is going to win because he's the biggest and the strongest and the most sort of storied, right? The most experienced, the guy in all the glittering armor. And the first thing that's interesting with that story, of course, is that once David changes the rules, he upsets the balance of power. And in fact, the sling that David has in his hand, if you go back and read accounts of ancient warfare, it's an incredibly devastating weapon. It has a stopping power equal to a handgun. A stone coming from a sling and also slingers were incredibly accurate, particularly experienced ones like David was. So first of all, he's got superior technology to Goliath. And then the other thing that's really fascinating is that there's been a lot of speculation among endocrinologists that Goliath had a condition called acromegaly, which is would account for his size. It's a tumor on your pituitary gland. But it also has a side effect, which is it causes severely diminished vision. And if you read the Bible story closely, Goliath has all kinds of strange behavior that can really only be explained by the fact that he probably couldn't see very well. So the point is that the minute you dig below the surface of that story, you realize that David isn't this impossible one-in-a-million underdog. And Goliath, even though he appears to be so strong, is actually in many ways acutely vulnerable. He's big, lumbering, slow-moving giant who's up against a guy with superior technology, and he can't even see him. You know, so that got me going in the book and made me realize, you know, that you can probably look below the surface of lots of cases where two people confront each other or we face a challenge, and you can, if you're careful, you can see a very different picture.
Why do you think we so often assign a certain trait to be advantageous when really it actually is working against us?
I don't know. It's a really interesting question. It's almost like we have a default mode where we assume because the giant's big and strong, he must be the overwhelming favorite. That it's almost like we privilege certain characteristics over others. So I have a chapter in the book about elite schools, colleges, pointing out that going to the best college you can get into has advantages, but it also has disadvantages. And I tell the story of a young woman who goes to Brown to study science and ends up dropping out. And her story is very typical that, of course, we have huge dropout rates in science and math in this country. And if you look at who drops out in science and math, it is almost always the kids in the bottom third of the class. And it's because they look at the students around them and they feel dumb. They feel like they can't do it. Now, what's interesting about that is that you don't drop out because you're not smart enough to do the work. You drop out because you measure yourself against your immediate peers and feel like you can't compete. So if she had gone to a less elite school than Brown, she probably would have gotten her degree in science. Less elite schools are less prestigious, but they can offer you more freedom, the ability to do things, to complete tasks, to get degrees that you might not be able to do at a more prestigious place. So there's a case where we have a kind of immediate reaction to colleges that says the most elite college I can get into is the one that confers the biggest advantage on me. But that's not true. That's only true in some cases. And so that's another example of this kind of the real story of advantage being more complicated than we imagine.
On the flip side, can disadvantages actually be advantageous?
Yeah, so that's what I explore in this. I have a whole section of the book which is concerned with what I call desirable difficulties. And this is an idea that comes from psychology where people have said, you know, most of the time when I make a task harder, more difficult to do, I impede your ability to do that task. I make it harder for you to learn what you need to learn. But that's not true all the time. There are other occasions where when I make your homework tougher, you end up learning more. And this, they call those kinds of things desirable difficulties. So I wondered whether, I have a chapter that asks the question of whether dyslexia can be, in certain cases, a desirable difficulty. And that's because we know from studying entrepreneurs that an extraordinary number of much higher than expected percentage of successful entrepreneurs suffer from dyslexia. And if you talk to them, and I interviewed scores of them, they will tell you that they think they succeeded not in spite of their dyslexia, but because of it. In other words, that being robbed of the ability to read easily and well forced them to learn other things, other skills that turned out to be way more useful to them in their chosen career than the conventional set of skills they would have had. The kids who make it through school with dyslexia, at least in the years before we were identifying it at an early age and giving people special programs, the kids who made it through were the ones who learned how to delegate, how to get other people to help them, to do their job, to communicate orally really well, to problem solve, to cope with failure. Those are all things that are incredibly important if you're going to be a successful entrepreneur. So for some, it's not for everyone, of course, it's for some. I think you can say that.
I was going to say, for every successful entrepreneur, though, you do have a child who suffers and perhaps ultimately leaves school because of their disability.
Absolutely. In fact, if you go to the prisons, if you go to any prison in this country and you test the prisoners, you'll also find a much higher percentage of people who have dyslexia. So it's this really fascinating thing where it's either it is a real handicap, or in some small number of cases, it appears to be advantageous. I think that's typical of a lot of what I'm describing, these kind of underdog traits. They are high risk. They are either you win or you really lose. There's not a middle ground here.
There's a term, a concept you talk about in the book called the inverted U curve. And it kind of goes along with this idea that there are limits to advantages, just as there may, in fact, be some advantageous parts to disadvantages.
Yeah. So this is this idea. It's a very simple notion, which is that something that is good in modest amounts rapidly becomes problematic in large amounts. And I started just by interviewing a very, very wealthy man who was talking about what his money had done to his children and how he realized after he'd made hundreds of millions of dollars and raised these kids that their lives had not been improved by him having that much money. He had robbed them of the chance to learn about the value of hard work and of self-reliance and of all these kinds of things. And I apply that. I think that's a rule that can be applied in lots of cases. And I use the example of class size. So we know that if you have very large classes and you reduce them, kids are better off. We have lots of evidence about that. If you go from a class of 35 kids to a class of 25 kids, it is a better learning experience for everyone involved. But there's a limit to how far you can push that. And so I looked at the research and also talked to hundreds of teachers and asked them the question, is there such a thing as a class that's too small? I was stunned to learn how many teachers said, absolutely. If a class gets too small, it's not a good learning experience anymore. There aren't enough voices in the room. There's not enough diversity of opinion. You can't have real discussion. Most crucially, kids who are struggling have a really hard time in really small classes because one of the things a kid who is struggling needs is someone else in the class who they can identify with, who's learning at the same pace, who's having the same problems, who's asking the same questions. They want company at the bottom, right? Otherwise, they feel isolated and marginalized. And if a class is too small, there's no one else who's having the same problems as they are, and they're all alone. And that's hugely problematic for kids who are struggling. And so that says, you know, you can take that principle too far. And I would argue that many private schools take that principle too far. Their classes are too small for effective learning. I would also argue that we have squandered a lot of money in this country, lowering class sizes past the point where it is educationally meaningful. That money would be much better spent on things like identifying high-quality teachers and paying them properly. I think we can be much wiser in how we use our educational resources by keeping that principle in mind.
So if we take all of this in total, what does this teach us about how we evaluate advantages, disadvantages, our strengths, our shortcomings?
I think it teaches us that we need to be a lot more thoughtful, and we also need to be suspicious of many of the kinds of advantages that come from material resources. I mean, a lot of my book is about how there is a limit to what you can buy, to the kind of success or advantage that you can buy. That a lot of what matters, really matters in producing positive outcomes in the world, are much more subtle psychological things, the kinds of things that are in your heart, not that you can purchase, that courage and spirit and faith and anger and all those kinds of things are much more important in who wins and who loses than who has most money or the most weapons or the shiniest armor. I mean, the book ends up with a discussion of religious faith because I think ultimately it's something like that is far more crucial in determining people's behavior than some of the other things that we dwell on.
Well, Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much for talking to us about David and Goliath.
I'm delighted. Thanks so much.
Best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1996. He is also author of The Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers, and What the Dog Saw, along with his latest book, David and Goliath. He'll be appearing in Milwaukee at UWM's Zelazo Center tonight for a sold-out event sponsored by Boswell Book Company. A stolen Stradivarius violin is still missing after a robbery in Milwaukee. How common are crimes like that? We'll speak with an expert in the field when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Police around the world are still searching for the Lipinski Stradivarius violin stolen from Milwaukee Symphony concertmaster Frank Almond on Monday night. Almond had just finished a concert and was taking the instrument back to his car when he was assaulted. The violin is worth millions of dollars and is a one-of-a-kind instrument, and so within hours, the Milwaukee police enlisted the help of Interpol and the FBI's Art Crimes Unit. That unit was founded a decade ago by experienced investigator Bob Whitman. Whitman has since retired from the agency and now runs a private consulting firm in the same field. Lake Effect's Bonnie North reached him by phone in Pennsylvania, and Whitman talked about how often crimes like this occur and what makes this particular crime distinct.
Well, it's a very significant case. That specific violin's got a fantastic history to it. It's well known. It's got a provenance. It's authentic, and it's a terrible situation when an artifact like that goes missing or is stolen. The whole world loses out on the ability to enjoy it. So it does happen, not that often, but these things do happen quite often. The Davidoff Morini violin was the last Stradivarius that I know of that was taken. That was back in the mid '90s in New York City. So that's been missing ever since that point. So this is not unique. It's happened before. Generally, we do get them back pretty quickly because, you know, there's not much you can do with them. Quite honestly, that's the problem with art theft and unique collectible theft. Sometimes it's easier to steal than it is to sell.
That leads me to ask why people steal it. If it is not easy to fence, it's not easy to get someplace where you can get money back for it, why are people doing this?
Well, Bonnie, you know, throughout my career, I've been doing this since 1988, and I've recovered more than $300 million worth of this type of material. And I've done cases in 22 different countries. So what I've always seen, time and time again, this is just over and over, is that these individuals are better thieves than they are businessmen. They're good at going out and planning a robbery or a theft. They case the institution or the individuals. They know their habits. They know when to move in, and they have a good plan on stealing. But then what happens is they're blindsided because of the fact that they think that these things are so valuable that they can move them on a black market. And basically, there is no black market for these types of materials.
So they really don't understand that they have no market to sell it into.
That's correct. That's what I've seen many, many times. The myth of a Dr. No out there who's collecting, that was started back in the early 1960s by a James Bond movie. And Dr. No in that movie, you know, he was collecting artworks and putting them in his cave. And quite honestly, in 30 years of doing these cases, I've never actually seen that occur. Not to that level where we have famous paintings in caves. So, you know, most collectors are good businessmen. That's why they can afford to collect. And they know the value of having good title of an object and the fact that if you don't have good title, you could be, exposed to a jail term.
So this experience that you've had with these kinds of crimes, is that what leads you to believe this was a targeted crime about money?
Yes. Well, that and the fact that all the crimes I've been involved in investigating throughout the years have always been about money. In the end, you know, even if the collector was interested in the artifacts that they were taking, the thief, then even then, it was still about what they were worth and how much they could get for them. So I've always seen it. It's always been about the value of the artifacts, the value of the artwork, much more so than the collection of the artwork.
Has there ever been a case where it was an attempt to defraud, say, an insurance policy?
Well, what you're talking about there is a case of someone trying to commit a ransom. And in the United States, ransom is illegal. It's an obstruction of justice. So therefore, money cannot be paid in ransom legally. So, yeah, there's cases where people are attempting that type of thing, but basically it's an illegal act. And the money doesn't get paid by insurance companies or anybody else. Now, in Europe, it's a different story. There are countries in Europe where items can be ransomed back to insurance companies through payments. Some countries allow that, and that does happen there. The problem with that, and the reason the United States does not allow that to happen, is because, well, first, it's a violation. Like I say, it's obstruction of justice. But also, it's because it creates more crime. Once people start paying ransoms, it makes it economically viable to steal.
Why do you think Europe hasn't put a cap on that?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. They work under different jurist systems. They have different laws that they work with, different legal systems. And as I say, you know, not everybody works under the same legal system the United States does. So in those countries that have different legal systems, payment for return of items is legal. So it's just how they run their countries.
So we're not likely to see this show up somewhere in Europe with that kind of a demand put on it?
Not likely, no. Because of the fact that it's a stolen property from the United States. I mean, I don't want to get into the legal aspect of it because I'm not an attorney, but since it's a stolen piece of property from the United States, some of the U.S. statutes would apply as to the ability to be able to work a legal deal in another country, because those countries do have stolen property laws, the same as we do, which makes it illegal to import stolen property.
But of course, if you're dealing with a black market situation, you know, you're not worrying about the law that much anyway.
Well, you know, people use that term black market, and I guess what they're referring to would be, you know, a quote collector who is unethical, who wants to buy artifacts cheaply. But, you know, in any event, when you're talking about a seven-figure artifact, you know, there's a certain money, amount of money that's going to be paid. I can remember one case I did in Copenhagen, Denmark, involving a $35 million Rembrandt that had been stolen at gunpoint from the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm. I was undercover at the time working with the FBI, and we were doing negotiations with the thieves in Copenhagen. And basically, we were going to buy the painting back for $250,000 in cash. So that gives you some idea. If you're talking about a $35 million painting, $250,000 was what we were offering, and they were accepting for the payment. Well, you know, that's a very good discount, so to speak. But in the end, that's still a lot of money. A collector who's going to buy something for $250,000 and not get good title, he's not going to be in the business very long.
Well, you've been quoted in a number of news sources here as saying you think the Lipinski violin is still somewhere here in town. Why do you think that? Why do you think it hasn't moved somewhere away from this police jurisdiction?
Well, because of the time frame at this point. Generally speaking, again, I've seen cases where, let's say, for example, that Swedish Rembrandt. You know, we did the case in 2005, and it was actually stolen at gunpoint from the museum in 2000. So it was still in Sweden 5 years, actually in Stockholm 5 years after it was stolen. I had another case in Madrid where 17 paintings were stolen worth around $65 million. We did that case within 2 years, and it was all the paintings were still in Madrid. And I've seen that happen over and over again. The thieves don't move the paintings. They hide them wherever it's closest for them. Then they start to go out looking for a buyer. And at that point, that's when we usually catch them, when these thieves start putting the items back up, to bringing it back to market, and they try to monetize their crime. That's when they get caught.
Well, we're not that far removed from Chicago. Do you think that might be a better place for a violin like this one to disappear or try to be sold in months or years to come?
In Chicago?
Yeah, moving it just south 90 miles.
Well, the point there is that this violin's unique. It's well known. It's actually quite famous. And it's in the Art Loss databases now. The FBI database has got a listing of it. And, you know, it's not something that's just going to be able to be sold at a flea market. It's something that if the individuals want to make a good profit on it, they're going to have to go to people who know what they're looking at. So I don't think they're going to have any better luck selling in Chicago than they would in Milwaukee.
In all the time that you worked on cases like this, both with the FBI and now as a consultant, what do you think motivates people? Is it trying to just pull off a perfect crime, or is it really just money and they just don't understand that they can't sell it?
I truly think that in most cases, and I would say probably 95% of cases that we've seen, it's about making money. It's pure greed. It's about, you know, it's about making money in an easy way, making a lot of money very quickly. And, you know, they don't think about how the situation is as it occurs. Now, you know, if you can go out and steal a car, you know, many times you can chop a car up and get more money than the actual car would have been worth by, you know, as a single unit. And so that's why you have chop shops, you know. And when you buy drugs, if you buy a kilo of cocaine, you chop that up into smaller amounts, then people sell that, and they make more of a profit than the actual cost of the whole kilo. But when it comes to art and these types of collectible properties, you can't chop them up. Can't do anything with them. The uniqueness of them, the fact that they are, you know, together in good shape and in good condition, that's what makes them valuable. And along with, of course, the authenticity, the provenance, and the good title. That's what they don't have. They don't have good title.
Right. And it sounds like that they're thinking that, you know, a kilo of cocaine and the Lipinski Strad are basically the same sort of thing. They're commodities that are worth something, but they're not the same at all.
Oh, no. And when it comes to the sale, they're going to find it's totally different. And that's why the investigation's got to go into a little bit of a different zone than a standard property crime. The beginning of an investigation like this should be like any type of property crime investigation. It doesn't matter if it's a Chevrolet or a Monet when you first start. But once you get into the secondary part of that investigation, then you have to start looking at the collector markets, the individuals who are involved in selling and buying these types of things, and having the business background in the art world.
Well, how likely do you think it is that we'll recover this?
I think that there's a very, very, very high chance, you know, probably a 90% chance that this violin's going to come back to the world. at some point it will be recovered. It might not be today. The question is when that's going to happen. Because I can tell you, I had one case involving a original copy of the Bill of Rights, which belonged to the state of North Carolina. It was stolen in 1865 by a Union soldier from the State House in Raleigh, North Carolina. And we recovered it in 2003. So that just gives you an idea. It was 138 years before we got it back.
Well, let's hope that it doesn't take that long for this.
No, we hope not.
Well, Bob Whitman, it has been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for your time.
Bonnie, thank you, and thanks for having me on. I'm sorry about the theft. It's a loss for all of us.
Bob Whitman retired from the FBI in 2008 after founding the agency's Art Crimes Unit. He now runs a private consulting firm in Pennsylvania and is the author of the memoir Priceless: How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. He talked with Bonnie North about the investigation into the Lipinski Stradivarius stolen Monday night in Milwaukee. How a Milwaukee-based group is trying to spark good things in one Milwaukee neighborhood. That story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee continues to be ranked by various studies as one of, if not the most, segregated city in the United States. Not only does that refer to the separation between whites and blacks in the city, but also to how wealth is represented. Less than 5 miles separate two of the area's wealthiest neighborhoods and one of its poorest. And in between is the Harambe neighborhood, basically bordered by Capitol Drive on the north, Center Street on the south, Highway 43 on the west, and Holton on the east. It's not the poorest of the city's neighborhoods, but Harambe struggles with many issues common to the city's inner-city communities. Its median household income is less than $30,000 a year, and only a quarter of its residents are college graduates. Yet in the last few years, Harambe has also been home to tens of millions of dollars in investment, new developments cropping up all over, increasing resident involvement, and revitalization of parks. But that story isn't well known, and that's where LISC Milwaukee comes in. LISC is the local chapter of the national group, the Local Initiative Support Corporation. It's working to break down those stereotypes and revitalize distressed neighborhoods. It regularly hosts bus tours through neighborhoods to show community partners and key policymakers what's happening now and could happen in the future. Not too long ago, LISC invited residents, community leaders, politicians, and business owners on a bus tour of Harambe to see just what's going on. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce takes us along as well.
Morning, morning.
Morning.
My name's Leo Reese, and I'll be your MC for today's program.
LISC Executive Director Leo Reese is at the front of a coach bus holding several dozen people, residents and policymakers, business owners and investors. They're about to tour the Harambe neighborhood, something LISC has been doing in communities around the city for the last couple years.
We really feel that Milwaukee's neighborhoods often get a bad rap, and I think there's a lot of misperceptions about what goes on in these neighborhoods. Now, we don't deny that there are challenges, but I think what we also want to point out is that there's a lot of remarkable people and a lot of remarkable stuff going on that you can't help but be inspired by. And that's what we need to get behind, and so that's what we want to share with you today.
Reese says LISC is a bridge builder, linking investors with people and partner organizations on the ground working to improve their neighborhood. Take, for example, the Harambe Great Neighborhood Initiative. This organization got started several years ago with a grant from LISC and has so far brought $45 million in development to the area. Chair J. Allen Stokes says the group is working on 16 action items, ranging from housing to public safety, that it hopes to address.
We are passionate about the growth and development of this neighborhood. And in addition to that, there's very good people who live here. A lot of times people don't take into consideration there's people here doing the best they can against the odds. And we stand by the people who live in this particular neighborhood. And we support their efforts to do what it is they can to make a better life for them and their families.
getting resident input is one of LISC's priorities. Meetings with locals have helped reshape and revitalize the nearby Clinton Rose Park, a nearly 150-year-old park that was once home to a shooting range, an amusement park, and even a Negro League baseball team. So far, the neighborhood initiative has installed a tot lot, softball field, splash pad, and two basketball courts. The group's Leif Ottesen.
It's really going to hopefully spur housing and other commercial development in the area. As many of you know, a strong park system and green space system really creates a hub for development. And we're looking to do that in the future with possible senior housing developments and housing rehab in the area.
LISC's partners have also responded to residents' concerns about problem areas, like helping to close a bar near 2nd and Keefe. Partner organization Riverworks Development Corps worked alongside police to increase public safety in the area. Riverworks AmeriCorps member Adrian Spencer is a longtime resident.
I've lived here for over 19, 20 years, but after some time of kind of battling with the bar and the violence that was occurring at night, we decided to move because there was just, my house had been shot up maybe four times. So at that point, it's not safe for my children. But I did decide to continue to press on with helping Riverworks and helping the community to kind of get rid of that problem so that everybody in the neighborhood could be safe.
80% of the problems are caused by 10% of the population.
LISC's Leo Reese.
And unfortunately, the police have to spend their time focusing on that 10%. But I think what we also need to do is invest in the other 80% of the people in the population so that people can, again, take control of their neighborhood.
That includes supporting Spencer and her mother in creating a so-called pocket park in nearby vacant lots.
And it was just garbage everywhere, just a real eyesore. And we thought that we could just get together, my mother loving the garden. So we just basically got together a team and went over, built the planters. And they really look beautiful in the summertime. Right now it's a little cold outside. But the children now utilize that park. Even families go out there and they do picnics. So the park is being utilized, and it is a really good project for the neighborhood.
Riverworks hopes to host quarterly events at the Pocket Park, from book bag giveaways to pumpkin carving to Easter egg hunts. From the Pocket Park to nearby Nigella Community Gardens, the LISC tour features several resident-driven projects.
Does anyone know what the word Harambe means? It means all pulled together.
That's Keith Hayes, executive director of the group Be In Tween. It's working to extend the Beerline bike trail another two-thirds of a mile from the River West neighborhood into Harambe along a vacant rail corridor. Hayes says the group is taking its cue from similar projects in New York, Atlanta, and Minnesota, and it's even come up with a neighborhood performance art contest to draw residents to the trail.
Beltlines or railways are basically just allowing pedestrian and bicycle access to connect communities, and from there you see all kinds of economic growth and development. Really helping some of these blighted corridors. And we saw a lot of houses and empty lots here in Harambe. One of the things we look at is trying to remove those problem lots, but I think one of the huge aspects we can look at is how to make this place something that people are proud of.
But it's hard to ignore the number of vacant houses and businesses in Harambe, which was hit hard by the foreclosure and financial crises. It's why Riverworks spent almost $7 million to rehab an old manufacturing site to turn it into 36 one- and two-bedroom affordable housing apartments. And it's why nonprofit real estate broker Axe Housing is helping local families become homeowners by rehabbing these vacant and sometimes vandalized homes. Axe Executive Director Carl Quindell says home ownership is the key to neighborhood stability.
We look at this problem as this incredible opportunity. It doesn't mean that it's not a crisis, that it's not horrible to hear the kind of numbers and the statistics get thrown around. I don't want to take anybody's attention off of the problem as if it's not a real problem. But what I think the homeowners that we partner with and home buyers that we partner with think about is how incredible an opportunity this is.
Axe has helped 240 families purchase homes since 2012, more than 70% of which were reclaimed foreclosure properties. Quindell says often new homeowners can buy a home for as little as $3,500 and pay less each month than they would in rent, a key factor in a community where the average family earns half the county median income.
I think the key thing is we put families in the neighborhood in charge. So we're selling the home to the neighbor next door that never knew they could access home ownership. And they're reclaiming them. They're saying, this is actually the reason, I can't believe it's a deal of a lifetime. I can't believe I can do this for my family.
To further stabilize the Harambe neighborhood, Lisk is working with the King Drive Business Improvement District to draw in more commerce. And on the same street is the last stop on Lisk's tour, a look at one of the most successful projects in Harambe. Over many years, the Martin Luther King Economic Development Corporation has brought more than $200 million worth of development to the MLK Drive corridor, including a kitchen incubator, a growing power store, and small business support. Its latest $10 million project phase created 41 rent-to-own houses, duplexes, and townhomes scattered throughout Harambe. Executive Director Welford Sanders says it's about building a cohesive community.
Because just as important as it to have retail and commercial strength along this corridor, it's also important to have some local demand that can support that retailing.
After the tour, many participants were impressed with what they saw, like Susan Hatch of Hatch Staffing of Milwaukee, who's also a member of LISC.
Actually, I have not driven in this neighborhood, I'm ashamed to say, in a really long time. I seem to stop at North Avenue, and the quality of the redevelopment is just really amazing. And it really is impressive, the commitment that the neighbors are doing to make their neighborhood a better place and a safer place.
And that's exactly the kind of impression Lisk and the Harambe neighborhood want to make. For Lake Effect, I'm Stephanie Lecce.
Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce produced our audio tour of the Harambe neighborhood led by Lisk Milwaukee. You can find photos and a list of the stops they made at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break and then a focus today and tomorrow on local food and urban agriculture in Milwaukee. We'll hear more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. It's more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. 2 days of nonstop conversation and workshops around the burgeoning topic of local food production and consumption kick off today at the 8th Annual Wisconsin Local Food Summit. This year, it's happening in Milwaukee at the downtown MATC campus. Food security and infrastructure development are among the topics attendees will discuss. A new homegrown initiative will also be featured. The Institute for Urban Agriculture and Nutrition is a collaboration of universities, civic, and community groups along with the city of Milwaukee. It grew out of a conversation between Will Allen, the internationally lauded founder of Growing Power, and UW-Milwaukee Chancellor Mike Lovell. The inspiration was to pull together expertise among scientists, educators, and community groups to jointly come up with solutions for the problems of broken urban food systems and the public health issues they create. The Institute is in its early development stage, but it's gathering steam. Its acting managing director picks up the story from here, but first we introduce several people involved in the project.
I'm Gretchen Mead. I'm the executive director of the Victory Garden Initiative, but I'm also here in this interview today because I'm on the steering committee of the Milwaukee Food Council, and I represent the Food Council for the Institute.
My name is Michael Carrier. I'm an assistant professor at the Milwaukee School of Engineering and also on the steering committee for the Institute for Urban Agriculture and Nutrition.
My name is Jesse Blum. I'm the Milwaukee director for the Sweetwater Foundation. I'm an educator with the Victory Garden Initiative, and I serve on the Community Collaborative Council for the Institute.
I'm Bonnie Halverson. I'm the acting managing director of the Institute. So the first thing that our chancellor did was bring in other academics, UW-Madison, UW-Extension, us, UW-Milwaukee, Milwaukee Area Technical College, Medical College of Wisconsin, Marquette University, and our newest member is Milwaukee School of Engineering. So all of these institutions have a lot of science to bring together to work on the problems that our community practitioners are facing doing urban agriculture. We also wanted to have at the table the voice of the community, so not only Will Allen from Growing Power, but also the Milwaukee Food Council, which Gretchen represents. That group has formed a community collaborative council on which Jesse sits. And that group is to create the research agenda that our academics will respond to. So we're not starting with the academics and finding out what they want to research. We're going to the community first and finding out what their problems are, and then we are going to apply the science to that. So what is, I don't know who wants to answer this, but what is the kind of research that is necessary? Is it the way soil is grown, or why don't we add fish, or what?
This is Jesse. I think the soil is a great opportunity for doing some research. I mean, in urban agriculture, we are always dealing with soil. And, of course, in an urban environment, we've got many contaminants that can be present in our soil. We don't have the resources necessary to make sure that we're growing out of healthy soil. And that's where partnerships with the research institutions can really help us out. There's so many agencies that are coming to the table now that can really ensure that we have the resources necessary as citizens to be growing healthy food.
This is Mike. I'm a historian by training, so when people talk about soil health, that's not my strength. So what I like is having this institute where I can reach out to other academics, other experts, to bring them into these projects. I have engineering students who can work on the infrastructure of things like raised beds, like aquaponic systems. We can then work with natural scientists from places like Marquette on how those systems actually work. So for me, it's having access to those resources. Also, it's more bluntly putting it, access to money. A lot of the projects that I've worked on have had incredibly small budgets. The idea of being able to partner with other organizations, partner with other academics on going after grants, makes this something that could lead to larger and larger projects, which to me is appealing. I think we've all come to the table with the idea that we can bring urban agriculture in Milwaukee to another level. The conversation we're now having is how that should look, how those conversations should unfold. In terms of possible pitfalls or problems, I think issues of diversity are huge. Reaching out to the demographics of the city, which are often in previous conversations on things like urban redevelopment, which I think this is, have been excluded. The idea that, in a sense, this is a fresh start for reimagining how a city can look and function. How do you get every sort of group to the table who should participate in that? That, I think, is a huge thing in terms of the demographics of the city, racial balances, gender balances. How do you get a collaboration that brings all of those parties to the table in an equal way.
Funding is coming the Institute's way, is it not? We've already received funding.
Grants. Our first grant was through the Growth Agenda for Wisconsin grant, which is the UW system. And it was because we did a joint proposal with UW-Madison and UW Extension. We received that first grant that started in July of 2013. And then we put in another grant proposal for the Healthier Wisconsin Partnership Program. That proposal had all seven universities on it as partners. We were evaluated on a national review board, and we were the highest rated proposal out of all of them that came in. So there's a lot of good reasons why people are interested in helping us get to where we're going, because we do have that unified voice of a lot of different people and a lot of people who are really passionate and really know what they're doing.
So what's next? What's needed to move to the next step?
Well, right now the Milwaukee Food Council is really gelling the Community Collaborative Council and picking that voice, that sort of think tank representative voice of the community's needs for research. And the next step is for the Academic Council to be created and to develop their process. So how is the Academic Council going to work with the CCC to draw those questions out? I think this is a pretty new way to go about it, so it's a new horizon for a lot of people here, I think.
Speaking from a researcher's perspective, I think this is, as Gretchen pointed out, kind of an inversion of the way these processes usually work. Often it's a top-down model where a researcher will decide what is or what isn't important, and then they'll essentially use the community as a test subject to figure out whether or not they were right. This is reversing that, which I think comes with a whole new learning curve and an idea of, particularly coming from the researcher perspective, learning to listen and learning to understand that I'm not the voice of expertise all the time, which I think for some people will be a problem. So the idea of creating avenues, channels through which to have those conversations and to ensure that each voice is heard. I think that is a huge thing. And it seems like so far it's been working. And so I'm encouraged by the progress made thus far.
Finally, I would think the barriers within a community, when you have people out there working their brains out and their mm-hmm. bodies, and we're going to make a difference here, getting those groups to shared, like, oh gosh, if I say this, then I'm going to lose this, is a natural tendency.
This is Jesse. I think it's important to note that this whole thing is still formative. Like, we're going to have our first community collaborative council meeting next week, Thursday, where we're bringing 12 representatives from the Milwaukee Food Council, which represent the Milwaukee food community, and we'll come together and we'll begin to discuss what sort of questions we want to bring to the academics as part of the project. And so we're still forming, and we're still, I think we're going to see how this collaboration and interaction works. But I think one thing that we do have is the excellent precedent that the Milwaukee Food Council has set, which does bring 60 plus people to the table every other month to share and discuss various projects that they're working on and create collaborations among community members. But to see it all come together, it's still very much formative, I guess.
Somebody sent me a UN report, hundreds of pages long, that is called Wake Up Before It's Too Late. And it really outlines the situation that we're in relationship to global sustainability and how the food system relates to that, how agriculture relates to that, and outlines the solution, which is essentially local, community-based, sustainable agriculture. I think probably everybody in this room is like feels validated, you know, because this is the way that our hearts have been driving our work, knowing that this is a solution. This is what we think is the solution as well.
For
a long time. And so to have this huge report from the UN come out is helpful. The big picture is the most important thing to me. This bigger picture of collaboration and making sure we get the work done is the most important thing to me. So if Victory Garden Initiative's mission finds a niche in the food world in Milwaukee because we're really good at one certain thing, that's okay with me, and that's the way that I think we're going to get it done.
This is Mike. Jumping off of that, as an educator, and I think it's a party we haven't discussed yet, is bringing students into this. And so the idea of being able to introduce students to this big picture and essentially train the next cadre of leaders to take these issues seriously and then to give them the tools to be able to do things, to address things like global food insecurity, that to me is incredibly powerful. And so the idea you have the community partners, you have academics, and now you have young people all engaged on this collective process, that's incredible.
And kids.
This is Bonnie. Actually, one of our projects in one of our grants is to fund at a grade school level these kids working with the Master Gardener volunteers to learn how to garden in their schoolyard. So it gets them started at that very young age. I think Jesse can speak more to that.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, as an educator of younger students, I'm really looking forward to working with some of these researchers on really identifying and validating the ways that we're teaching our young people through food to really appreciate the world, to learn the science, technology, engineering, math disciplines. You know, up to this point in time, each of our programs have been pretty isolated in the work that we do, and we rely upon, you know, some of these broader reports that are on the national scale. But what we have the opportunity to do is partner up with individual researchers who can really focus a lens on our particular projects and show either individually or collectively the effect that we are having on these students. And so as an educator, I'm particularly excited about that.
That interview was produced by WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. She spoke with Bonnie Halverson of the Institute for Urban Agriculture and Nutrition, Gretchen Mead of the Victory Garden Initiative, Michael Carrier of the Milwaukee School of Engineering, and Jesse Blum of the Sweetwater Foundation. The Wisconsin Local Food Summit is today and tomorrow at MATC in downtown Milwaukee. That's Friday's Lake Effect. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with production assistance from Eleanor Peterson, Nathan Royster, and Craig Wirrell, and the web expertise of Michelle Maternowski. I'm Mitch Tyke. Have a great weekend. Above zero temperatures, grab your swimsuit. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air is next. Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock.